Audi.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the Big Travel Podcast. I'm Lisa Francesca Nand. Graham Simsion became a publishing phenomenon with his debut novel, The Rosie Project, and follow-up, The Rosie Effect, selling over 5 million copies worldwide. And the final book in the trilogy, The Rosie Result, is out now. There's a proposed Hollywood adaptation of the story in the works, and Bill Gates is even a fan. Travel is an integral part of all his stories, whether rural France, Melbourne, or even a grey day in Manchester. Graham Simsion has delightful stories for you here on the Big Travel Podcast. You've been on tour for 3 months. You're touring the... Where are you touring?
Okay, so, well, I've started off in Australia and New Zealand and, you know, all states of Australia and then up to New Zealand. And I've been around the US, Canada, and now I'm here just in the UK for a week doing a few little spot visits.
But I know from chatting to you before we started recording that you're very familiar with a lot of these places you're travelling with. Why don't we start actually by you telling us about your books? I know The Rosie Project was one of your first books. Well, actually, you've written books before there, but it was one of your first bestsellers. Am I right?
Okay. My very first book was called Data Modelling Essentials, and it's likely to be of interest only to a very small proportion of your listeners.
So I was going to say, I don't think I know what data modelling is. I don't think I actually want to know what it is.
No, I think it's a very good response. So my first novel was, in fact, The Rosie Project. So I wrote The Rosie Project, which is the story of Don Tillman, a socially challenged geneticist, and his search for the perfect woman. Followed that with The Rosie Effect, which is the story after he's found the perfect woman, although not quite what he was expecting, and his challenges to keep a long-term relationship going, something that's very, very close to my heart.
We have everyone else is, I'm sure.
Well, we have so many books about falling in love, not so many about staying in love, about the value of long-term love as distinct from romantic love. And then my third book sort of compared the two of those, long-term love and romantic love. It's The Best of Adam Sharp, and it's a story of a man whose great love of his life from his younger days comes back and gets in touch again and threatens the relationship, the long-term but somewhat dull relationship that he's been sitting in. And followed that with Two Steps Forward, very travel related. This is set on the Camino de Santiago de Compostela.
Lovely.
Written in partnership with my wife, alternating chapters. So that's Two Steps Forward. And the most recent book is back to Cat the Rosie series. It's The Rosie Result. Don and Rosie's 11-year-old son is struggling at school with the same problems that Don had as a child. And the school has said that maybe an autism diagnosis is appropriate here. And Don is suitably horrified because he's never thought he might be autistic.
These are very real subjects that I'm sure we can all relate to. And this is probably why you've sold over 6 million copies worldwide.
About five, I think.
About five.
Not including the data books. But look, they're close to people's hearts. And these are comedic books. So these are definitely, particularly the Rosie books, are definitely written as comedies. And there's a bit of a trace of comedy in the other couple of books. And I think that's part of the appeal. But you can, I'm a great believer that you can use comedy to tackle some of the most important topics.
Now, the Santiago de Compostela route is something I've always wanted to do. I grew up in Spain. I spend a lot of time in Spain. I've never done the route. Tell me about the route. I'm presuming that you walked it to research your book.
Okay. Well, when you say the route, when people talk about the Camino, they are generally talking about walking from St. Jean-Pied-de-Port or Roncesvalles on the French-Spanish border through to Santiago de Compostela, which is the destination where the the bones of St. James the Elder are supposedly buried and, you know, held in the tomb at the cathedral. Obviously, back in the 9th century when this started, or 9th or 10th century, not everybody started at St. John Pierre de Port. They had to get there. So from all over Europe, there are feeder routes to there, as well as alternative routes, because obviously you're starting from Lisbon, you don't go to St. John Pierre de Port. You take an entirely different route. So all of them have in common they end at Santiago de Compostela, but they are all over Europe. And the romance of this is you can find a scallop shell symbol, which is a symbol of the route, finger post, as it were, anywhere in Europe, and you can start following those signs, and you will be on a tributary of a track which comes from another tributary which joins the main route, and eventually find yourself in Santiago. My wife Anne and I were staying in a small village in France. We saw the scallop shell, and we decided that we would do this walk from there. So we actually ended up walking around. The traditional route from St. John Pierre de Port to Santiago is about 500 miles, 800 kilometers or so. We walked from central France, and that ended up being just over 2,000 kilometers, 1,200 miles.
How long did that take for you?
87 days. We had 2 days off in that time, my wife's birthday, a little celebration when we got to St. John Pierre de Port, at the official starting point, where we'd actually planned to stop. But we made a decision that we would press on and go all the way.
That sounds like an incredible journey.
It was.
What was your standout moment from it?
Oh, I have to say, arriving in Santiago.
Many people say this when I ask them about the journey.
At the beginning of the journey, we met with a guy who gave us our credentials, our sort of walking passports that you get stamped at each night. And he gave us a little advice. He'd walked it five times, I think. And he said, he had three predictions. He said, one, you'll get blisters. Two, the walk will change you. And three, which is probably two, when you get to Santiago Cathedral, you will cry. Now, I didn't cry. I'm not a very emotional guy, but my wife was certainly choked up and so forth. And we were there. It's an amazing feeling of having done it.
I'd definitely be crying. Yeah. Not just because of the blisters. Obviously, lots of people do tell me when they do these long journeys that actually arriving is very good, but sometimes an anticlimax. But did you meet any interesting people along your way?
Well, lots. Although the first time we walked it, we didn't take the main route. You say the first time is obviously another story.
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
We walked as far as St. John Pierre de Port, and we decided to take the alternative coastal route, the Camino del Norte, and then the Camino Primitivo, which is one of the oldest routes that cuts inland and so forth, but much less frequented. So we didn't meet as many people as you would walk on the quite crowded Camino Frances, which is the most well-known route. But probably the most important meeting that we had was in the first 2 weeks of walking. We were walking essentially from Cluny in France on a feeder route coming to Le Puy-en-Velay, where one of the well-known French routes starts. And it was 2 weeks walking, and we weren't even sure we'd go beyond that 2 weeks. That was as long as we'd ever walked in our lives. And we only met one other walker by day or by night, at hostels or anything. We were walking in winter, so it was not the peak season. He was a young Belgian guy, 19 years old, carrying a huge pack, and we fell in with him and so forth. And after he'd found out that we were both aspiring writers at that stage, he said, I've got the solution for you. He says, you should write a book set on the Camino, a novel. He said, you should write it together. And he said, it should be a love story about old people. So he very much summed us up, I think. And we thought that was such a silly idea, really, because you don't normally write novels together or anything like that. But, you know, once we each done our own thing, and I'd done the Rosie Project, and my wife had been published, and she's published now as a crime writer. Anne Buist is her name, and her books are available in England, in the UK, sorry. We took that up, and we took up a suggestion, and we then walked the Camino again for, I would say, research purposes, if the tax man is listening, but also for the pleasure of doing it again. And this time we walked we took the same route through France, essentially, but this time we walked the main popular Camino Frances.
So I'm quite intrigued by this mysterious Belgian dude that you met. He's not like the old Oracle guy. He's a 19-year-old with a backpack, and he said, you shall walk the Camino de Santiago. You shall write about it with your wife. Yep. It should be a love story.
And, you know, I had his contact details down somewhere and lost them, but we have memorialized him in the book. He's inspired a character, the German Bernard, who is, and it really came from one night where this guy was traveling with virtually no money. And we said, what do you do for accommodation? He says, look, every time, you know, I get to a village, I just find a woman to sleep with. And Anne explained to him, after he used that expression a couple of times, that this probably wasn't the best English phrasing to use. But it inspired.
Is that what he meant, though? Did he mean that
he would go to the municipal offices and they would find typically a Catholic lady who would offer her house to pilgrims, and he would sleep in his own bed and receive Catholic hospitality or charity, as it were, as a pilgrim walking the Camino. So we created this character Bernard, who's also walking without paying, as it were, but he's perhaps he takes a more literal interpretation of that, of what our man said.
Well, should we try and find him, this Belgian guy? We have lots of listeners in Belgium. I used to live in Belgium. Should we try and find him?
Okay, so this was 2011, starting February 2011, and his name was Matthias. Matthias is out there somewhere. He was carrying a huge pack. We don't even know if he finished because he was having a lot of knee problems with his huge pack. And he had started in Switzerland and just drawn a straight line originally to Santiago de Compostela and decided he'd walk the straight line and found there were mountains and no paths.
Was that a surprise to him, the mountains that separate France and Spain? Yeah.
So he ended up on well marked tracks and so forth, and that's where we met him. But Matthias from Belgium.
Matthias, he was 19 in 2011. Help me with the maths.
Okay, so he must be 27 now.
27. He had bad knees at the time. He was carrying a massive backpack, and he said, "You should go."
And he started. The important thing is, he started in Switzerland. That would be a really differentiating point.
Okay, and he didn't know there were mountains in between.
Well, he certainly didn't take them into account. I don't want to flag him as ignorant. He did express a desire to do this sort of walk in Australia, which is just not feasible in the same way, because you can't walk village to village in Australia. You run out of villages very quickly.
It's so vast, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, shall we move on to Australia? Because you're from Australia, as that accent would indicate.
Well, I was actually born in New Zealand, but I moved to Australia when I was 12, so I spent most of my life living in Australia.
And many of your books are based in Australia, in Melbourne, is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, look, I'm a writer who is not particularly good at it's making stuff up as far as locations, appearances and so forth, so I draw from life. So I set my books in cities, even in houses that I have known. In fact, when I wrote The Best of Adam Sharp, I needed a house in Norwich. And
that's England, I should say. There isn't some Norwich in the outback.
There probably is. Norwich is everywhere. This is Norwich, Norfolk, England, where I lived in a flat in 1984, 1985. But I didn't want our character to live in a flat. I wanted them to live in a regular house. And actually, Emma Healy, the author of Elizabeth is Missing, very kindly let me poke through her house in Norwich so that I could get a sense of the geography. Because I don't want you to have something in the book where he says he walked from the living room to the kitchen, and then later on he walked down the hallway from the living room to the kitchen. And
also in Australia, you're so much more used to massive houses compared to the ones we have here. You probably don't understand the compactness of a house in Norwich compared to one sprawling in a suburb in Melbourne.
Certainly the layout, and just things like box rooms and so forth.
Yes, we have box rooms.
Yeah, an Australian wouldn't know what a box room
is. I know a lot of my American friends, I don't know about Australian houses for this, but they get annoyed with us that we have the washing machine downstairs in the kitchen, because it doesn't make any sense. They have it upstairs in a utility room, so you can just put your clothes away and, you know, transfer them easily from one place to another. So when I'm rich, I'm going to have a washing machine upstairs or a utility room. Does that make sense?
It does indeed. But you're right about Australians largely enjoying, particularly English people who move to Australia, say, wow, I can have, a quarter acre block or whatever. Whereas, I actually live in the inner city, really. So I've just got an apartment. So
Melbourne's amazing. Describe Melbourne to people who haven't been there. I absolutely love it.
Well, it has a reputation as one of the world's most livable cities and usually ranks very high on those. It's a very multicultural city. So I don't think of Melbourne so much in terms of the planning side of it, although my father was chief planner for Melbourne for many years.
Oh, that's a claim to fame.
And so it's quite good with parks, and that was one of his legacies.
Massive park. What's that park in the middle with the big needle point in it?
Botanic Gardens,
yes.
You think of? Yeah, I know what you're thinking of, where the Maya Music Bowl is and so forth, which actually features in The Best of Adam Sharp.
Oh, okay.
They go to a Christmas Carols by Candlelight at the Maya Music Bowl, which is an absolute feature of the Melbourne scene. But I don't think of Melbourne as much in terms of geography. I mean, it's got sprawling suburbs and so forth, as much in terms of the people, the culture. It's a good food city. It's a good cultural city. You know, we have the competition with Sydney, but it's generally Sydney's got the harbour and we've got the culture.
So what, I know you've travelled quite extensively. What should I ask you about your travels?
Well, probably how they've played into the books, because I've travelled a lot, and I've travelled on book tours and so forth. I've travelled for just plain tourism, and before that I travelled as an information technology teacher and you know, consultant. So
this is back to the data.
Yeah. But look, I've really had some great travels around the book. So I've been to Poland, I've been to Hungary, I've been to Bhutan. Now there's, you know, for a Bhutan Writers Festival. So it's been wonderful where the books have taken me.
Has the travel aspect of writing and getting the books published, has that been one of the best parts of it?
My wife certainly thinks so. And in fact, when we got the advance for the Rosie project, I was already moderately financially secure. I'd sort of semi-retired to write. And, you know, we got quite a little bit of money coming in from Rosie project. What do you want to do with this? And you said, I want to turn left when I go onto a plane. So
yes,
we get to fly business class, which is great for older people like us. It means you can sleep on those long flights from Australia. But, you know, there's no country I'd sort of separate out and say, look, that was the absolute best travel experience. And once again, I enjoy the people more than the geography.
Tell me about Bhutan. I've never been.
Well, first of all, Bhutan has a real reputation as a hard place to get to. You really have to, you know, I mean, practically speaking, you tend to go via India. But just tourism there has traditionally been difficult in terms of visas, minimum spending requirements and all that. And it's a mountainous country. And I think the most dramatic thing about Bhutan was flying in, and apparently only a few pilots are sort of licensed to fly into this airport, which is just, it's a mountain. It's a country of mountains, not of plains. And it's just all mountains. So just flying in was great. And we saw Everest. We actually saw Mount Everest from the air, which we hadn't been able to see when we visited India, and because it was just too foggy, too smoggy. But there we finally got to see Everest from the air, and we walked up to one of the famous monasteries, and, you know, so it's about the mountains.
And are you well received? So when you go to somewhere as foreign, you know, to us as Bhutan, and you sit there and you're reading extracts from your book, who's attending?
Well, look, the Bhutan Writers Festival, I think, is very interesting because it's very heavily sponsored by India, who are very keen to maintain good relationships with Bhutan, perhaps in competition with Bhutan's other important neighbour, China, on the other side. So it's a very strategically placed country. Look, I think, to be honest, I think some of the seats were filled with students. It's all pretty new, getting fiction produced and read in a very small country. The highlight for me, and I'm going to have trouble remembering her name because Bhutanese names, probably Bhutan's most famous writer, whose best known book I had read prior to coming to Bhutan as background novel, and I got to sit together at dinner, and it was just an honour to meet her and chat, and she said very good English about writing in Bhutan, about being an author in Bhutan. I think like anything, if you work in a profession or a craft or whatever, it's always interesting to meet people in other parts of the world who are doing the same sort of work as you and discuss how life is. And always visiting a country is far more interesting if you have something to do there other than to sort of walk around gaping.
So where else has been very interesting along your travels? Where has really captured your heart?
We actually have a house in France, which is a very traditional place to travel and spend time. But it ended up absolutely coincidental. We decided we'd take 6 months off. We're going to spend it in Italy and get to know Italy better. And we had so much trouble finding a place to stay in Italy for that extended period of time that wasn't going to charge us by the week. This is before the days of Airbnb and so on. And ended up finding a place in France. Fell in love with the area in southern Burgundy and kept coming back, and eventually bought a small place which we spend time in. So in terms of capturing the heart, and I speak a little French, which obviously, if you speak the local language even as badly as I speak French, it obviously helps with how you fit in and so on.
So describe to me where you live. Have you bought a house? What is it, in a village?
It's in a village. I won't name the village, but it's not far from Cluny.
Ah, this is where your walk starts.
That's where we started our walk. We did what the ancient pilgrims did. We just walked out the door and started walking towards Santiago de Compostela and following the signs. And we only had to go, you know, 100 yards before there was the first sign.
I've never seen these signs. I don't know why I'm not looking
out for them. You have to be looking. Once you get an eye for them, of course, when you're walking.
And it's a shell.
It's a stylized scallop shell. Just look up Camino de Santiago and you'll see those stylized scallop shells everywhere in sort of blue and yellow. And they're on lampposts and so forth. You You find them exiting a village, typically be easiest to find. I mean, if you know where the Camino runs, then you find a bit of Camino, which will be along roads in some places. And also at cathedrals, they pass all of the major churches that are on the route. So you walk to a church in a town that is on the route, and you will find a scallop shell.
I had a lovely man called Alistair Humphreys on recently, and he's done lots of very vast and wide exploring. But one of the things he did not so long ago, and he wrote a book about it, is follow in Laurie Lee's footsteps, yes, from northern Spain down to Madrid and beyond. And he was talking about sleeping out under the stars, and he had these beautiful, evocative stories about Spain and meeting Spanish people. And it made me go back, and I read Laurie Lee as I walked out one midsummer morning. What I wondered is, because I'd love to do a long walk like that, particularly in Spain, are you on roads? Can you avoid the motorways? Because we've got a lot of motorways, sadly, these days. How do you avoid those?
Well, I think one of the trouble is that, particularly the northern route, the original path is pretty obviously where they built the freeways. And walking the Camino del Norte, and my wife and I found it, there were some long stretches on the edge of the freeway. And frankly, they were not fun. I mean, we had a picture of walking along beaches, and that was pretty much the way it was promoted. And there are moments where you're doing that, but you are certainly not walking beaches all the way. Whereas the Camino Frances, the has been pretty well protected. Yes, there are some sections along road, but not too many. The path itself is pretty good. And the section in France, I mean, the interesting thing to do is to, if you want an interesting walk, is to take on something like the French section. Beautiful. Yes, there are a few sections along roads, but not too many. It's largely through forests and so on. So it's great.
That sounds amazing. I really have to do it. So what does a typical day involve when you're in your holiday home in France?
Well, it involves writing. Both Anne and I write, and we collaborate, meaning we are each other's first and last readers. We plot together and so forth. So a typical day is up in the morning, go for a jog, come back, have breakfast, write. Maybe go shopping in the village and get some lunch, maybe have a coffee in the village. And then the two of us will just sit in the main living room just with our computers, typing away and using me as a sort of human thesaurus, saying, how do you spell this? Or you've got another word. I'm thinking of a word that's such as that. I use her as a sort of one-person appreciation society. Just listen to this. How funny is this? Well, not that funny, whatever. And then about 6 o'clock, we'll pour a glass of wine. We'll start cooking dinner together, perhaps on the barbecue, depending on the weather. We've got several little zones, different places where we can have a drink. We don't have too many alcohol-free days. And we chat about what we've been writing and what challenges we've been facing, have dinner.
Oh, my God, that sounds like the absolute dream.
No television.
Internet?
Yes.
You need it for work, don't you?
Yes, we have it, but it's not particularly fast. It doesn't encourage its use. It's there if you need it.
So in the evenings, you'll be sitting and chatting and having a glass of wine and maybe reading a book and all that.
Yep,
all
that old school
stuff. Jealous. Yeah. That sounds amazing.
It's just a lovely way to live, and I'll be doing it again very soon. So,
have you met any colourful local characters?
The most, in many ways, that we have a caretaker, for want of a better word. It makes it sound very poosh, but there's a little apartment that the previous owner built above the garage, and friends of friends knew a chap who just recently separated from his partner. He's about 10 years older than me, and so he's been living up there. He speaks no English and French with a really heavy Burgundian accent that really limits our communication, I'm here to tell you. It's like, I think, like dealing with someone with a very heavy Scottish accent or something like that if you're not a native English speaker.
Even for native English speakers.
Native English speakers, yeah. I remember when my previous partner was working as a medico in Norfolk, they had to bring in a translator and interpreter at one stage between her Australian and their heavy sort of Nafa accent. But our caretaker is lovely guy who, up until recently, has been looking after the garden, but he's fallen on sort of poor health and he's still there. And we've sort of become very friends with very poor communication.
So you've used France in the books, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I use France, obviously, as a starting point and, important point in the Camino de Santiago and Two Steps Forward. And I think it makes the book a little bit of a point of difference that most Camino books are memoir, not fiction. There's very little fiction around. Having the French part of it just gives you a little bit of a point of difference. But also, in The Best of Adam Sharp, I set it deliberately in three places, and it's sort of around the mood of the book, that Adam's in Norfolk and in Manchester, and when we open it, he's in his current life in his late 40s in Manchester, and it's a bleak Manchester sort of day. And this is his life. It's a bit bleak. It's not bad, but it's not. It's a bit grey.
We can all relate to those days in England. We can.
And then he reflects back to when he was living in Melbourne, sunny Melbourne, doing his 6 month or so contract, where he falls in love, and the sun is shining, and there's beaches, and all the things that you associate with Australian life, but also it being a holiday. This was a vacation for him, some time out working when he really belonged to England. And therefore, it gives that sense of temporiness to the relationship that he falls into, that he's visiting here with his relationship, that he's not really serious about marrying this Australian girl, even though he's madly in love with her, because he's on holiday. It's a holiday romance. And then in the second part of the book, where they get back together, as it were, with her husband in tow. So she and her husband invite Adam to come and stay in their holiday home in France. And it quickly becomes apparent that the marriage is in trouble, and that she's got some sort of fairly serious agenda, which Adam spends a lot of time trying to find out what's going on. And you think of French, you think of French farce, you think of perhaps the French as being just a little bit more libertarian in their approach. So this is where things turn a bit more Sex, Lies, and Videotape. So those three places were, and it's a village. It is, a village. It might be modeled a little bit on where our house is.
You're very much drawing from your life on this.
Absolutely. Well, at least the location. And a village has that sense of isolation. You're not in the middle of a big urban place. So this is just us out here, just the three of us. And really, they're the only characters, plus the caretaker.
This sounds amazing. I'm sold. I have to say that sometimes with my guests, I have time to read their books. And with you, I haven't had time to read your books. And I'm definitely sold on all of them. It sounds like I'll be plowing through those through the summer.
Well, The Best of Adam Sharp will certainly take you to Manchester. It will take you to Norwich. It will take you to Melbourne a lot more. And it will take you to France.
To the south of France.
And it will take you into some somewhat transgressive sex. So you just need to be a little bit broad-minded.
Transgressive sex. Okay,
it's not the Rosie Project. There are three people in this house.
Oh, that sounds brilliant. I want to ask you what happens at the end, but obviously you can't tell me. I'll have to read it.
Well, at the end, Adam has to figure out what's going on. And then, because it's the nature of the premise of the story, he is going to have to make a choice between the great love of his life, who's come back, the unresolved love, the glamorous one, the one that got away, and the steady person that he's been living with for 20-odd years and has walked out on to pursue this.
Oh, that's amazing.
Or the third possibility of neither of them and to move on and enlighten, start something new.
I can't wait to find out what happens to Adam. I will definitely be reading that. I know you've also travelled extensively around the US.
Yeah. I spent a lot of time professionally travelling around the US, giving courses, doing consulting work, and now, of course, on book tour, which can take you to all sorts of parts. And people, and the great lesson I've learned is, do not generalise about the US of A. Just when you've said all Americans are like this, or this is a strongly held view, someone's going to pick you up in a taxi in Pocatello, Idaho, or something like that, and have a completely different political view, or be hugely enlightened about something, or know the world better. Yes, there are some generalizations you can make, you shouldn't make them.
Is that person a real character, the taxi driver that had some enlightened views?
Oh, look, plenty of taxi drivers will say all sorts of amazing things that you hadn't expected.
I do love a taxi driver.
I turned up in Pocatello, Idaho one time to see a Dylan concert, which I made an impulsive decision to go to. It was what workshop do I choose on the first day of a conference, which I think was in New York. And I was stopping over for some reason in Salt Lake City. There was a commuter flight to Pocatello, Idaho. Dylan was performing and there were tickets. And I just jumped on that plane and went to see Bob. I've arrived at the airport in Pocatello and I'm looking around for a taxi, and someone's come up and said, no taxis here, there's about three in town or whatever. But this couple, who were older than me, offered me a lift to my hotel that I had booked. They then picked me up and took me to the concert, and they weren't going themselves, and picked me up after the concert and took me back to my hotel. It was just such lovely, lovely people. And that's the sort of a thing about humans that you just hold on to.
That's the sort of thing about travel, though, isn't it? Travel exposes you to those sort of experiences, makes you a little bit vulnerable. So you have to trust the local that offers you a lift.
And they trusted me. I had a shaved head and an earring at that stage, because we do in Australia, I think you do it here, a shave your head to support cancer research. And I'd done the sponsored head shave, and I'd put the earring in just to go with it, and a beard. And I probably didn't look the safest sort of, data management consultant that I was.
Have you ever been somewhere where you felt completely out of your comfort zone?
A couple of times I have. When I was much younger, I felt in Morocco, I felt uncomfortable. I felt mainly uncomfortable because both my partner and another woman were with us, and the other woman was being hassled. And it was having to really step in and just do something, and she was making it a lot worse. You can't control what someone else is going to do, and she was busy digging a hole for herself. I felt physically threatened under those circumstances. Look, Paris can be a bit like that occasionally now, where you feel physically pushed. I know my son came back from Paris, and he speaks fluent French and has a black belt in karate, and is a biggish guy, unlike me. And he and his girlfriend were there, and he was pushed and shoved by and felt genuinely threatened. And there was another case where he was on exchange and a girl was actually really badly assaulted in the same buildings that they were in while he was asleep. So, but I've traveled enormously. I very, very seldom felt in danger. And it's not like that those things wouldn't happen in your own city.
Where have you felt happiest? Apart from Australia and the house in France.
Oh, you took out two. Well, I'm going to say Spain, because walking in Spain, really enjoyed, an enormous sense of freedom when you're walking and there's nothing but what's on your back. What inspired me, encouraged me to walk the Camino, was a long time ago reading Carol Shields' book, The Stone Diaries, where a guy just sheds everything and starts walking in the UK, in fact, and walking right up to the north, to the Orkneys. Yeah. I really, at that time, was sort of carrying the heavy corporate burden and so forth, and thought, wow, if only. And when my wife suggested that we do the Camino walk, that was the image that came straight back to me, and I thought, yeah, I'd like to do that.
I really want to do it. I kind of want your life. I want to sit in a house and write abroad and walk and drink wine in the evenings.
I have a wonderful life, and I'm extremely grateful to have it. But you are very aware that it can change in an instant. And I think you have to live life knowing that.
You do, you really do. So I'm going to ask you my last question now. My last question is always about music, because to me and to many people I speak to, music and travel go hand in hand, because music helps evoke and cement memories. And if you had to choose one song that reminded you of a special or memorable time and place of travel, what would that song be?
Okay, that's an easy one, but can I have an experience as well?
Okay. Absolutely.
So walking the Camino, we had one of those sort of quintessential hiking experiences where a whole bunch of people after a whole day's walking and so forth had just assembled together. And there was a chap there who could play guitar. He picked up a ukulele that was hanging on the wall, managed to work out how to use that. And he played Leonard Cohen's song Hallelujah, which sort of everybody knows today. I've had a harmonica which I packed with me, so I was playing fills and so forth, a little solo on that, and we had a woman with a beautiful voice singing it, and it was just that, that quintessential hiking moment where you've got a bottle of wine. We were in a bar where you had a bottle of wine open and all those sorts of things. So that would be the one that would bring back that memory. And I'm a big Leonard Cohen fan as well, so that's a big positive too. Look, the other was a moment many years ago where I visited the parish church in Eddington in the UK, Eddington, Wiltshire, where my ancestors are buried. So this is, doing some family history tracing and so forth. And we discovered coincidentally that night the Welsh Boys Choir would be singing the service the next day, but they were having, and it would be recorded by the BBC, but they were having a rehearsal that night, and it was a free rehearsal that you could come along to. So we just walked into the church. Nobody spoke. There was no announcements, no nothing. The choir came on. They sang the mass and we walked out. And it was the most spine-tingling musical moment of my life.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for coming on the Big Travel Podcast.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you so much, Graham, for that delightful introduction to your books. I'm looking forward to reading them. And thank you very much for listening to the Big Travel Podcast.